I'm Ken McLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Awakening from Belief, Part 3.
While we're waiting for people to gather, one of the things that I enjoy very much is just responding to questions. So let's be a little informal here. Anything that's come up through your practice this morning or through anything that's been said, or questions about other topics that you might be interested in hearing a different point of view or the same old point of view, I don't know. Yes.
I've been kind of thinking about what you said about belief and about the view that we get presented by our teachers, things in the past. And it's really easy to take that as a belief rather than sort of a description to explore and see if you might see it in a different way.
This is very, very true. How many of you are familiar with Stephen Batchelor? Oh, do we have an extra mic?
No, I guess not.
Okay.
I'm not really familiar with the system. I was thinking about that. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind if you could
encapsulate the question.
In brevity, in a precise manner.
Okay, I'll try and do that. So, when we encounter teachers, we can easily fall into a belief system rather than using what is being presented as an invitation to explore things. Basically, that's your point. Stephen Batchelor is, I can't remember if he's Canadian or English originally, I think he's Canadian originally, moved to England, trained in the Gelugpa tradition for many years. And as he said to me once, he will talk to one of his Gelugpa teachers and said, I've had such and such an experience in my meditation. And his teacher said, you can't have had that that experience because you haven't completed your training in logic. it wasn't quite that smooth, but it was basically that was the process. And he explored the Theravadan tradition before finding a teacher that really spoke to him in the Korean Zen tradition, which is quite a bit different from the Japanese Zen tradition. So he's very well versed, and he's a scholar and academic by inclination, so extraordinarily well read and deeply well read in many traditions of Buddhism. He's written a number of books, and one of them, which I think is not his best book, but it's quite uneven, is called The Faith to Doubt. And he starts it off by noting the way doubt is viewed. In the Tibetan tradition, as most of you probably know, doubt is viewed as a bad thing. You know, you have to have faith. There's a strong devotional component in Tibetan tradition. And in the Abhidharma, doubt is listed as one of the negative mind states, the impediments. And then you have, you can always trust the Zen people to turn things upside down, that wonderful phrase in Tibetan, big doubt, big enlightenment, little doubt, little enlightenment, no doubt, no enlightenment. And in this book, one of his opening paragraphs says more or less exactly what you're saying. I think of the way he says it is, in its institutional forms, Buddhism has provided very powerful answers to questions of the spirit. However, sometimes the power of those answers overwhelms the stammering voice which is asking the questions. And in my own work in Los Angeles, one of the things I've always tried to do is to hear the stammering voice in the student rather than saying, this is how it is. It is very, very much a process of exploration. And there's a critical period in everybody's practice, and it's not an easy period. And it's a period where you move from relying on the tradition of your training and your teacher's instructions and all of that to making the practice your own. And it's difficult because you feel like you're betraying the tradition and you're turning your back on your teacher, because you're going to, in that process, you're dropping what actually doesn't work for you, and you're taking up what does work for you. And so it's very, very mixed emotionally. And as you work through that, you find out one of two things. Either had a good teacher and everything that he or she said now rings true to you, but in a very, very different way. Or you had a teacher that actually didn't know that much. and then there's a whole process of disillusionment and recovery and everything like that. But it's very, very important for students to do that. And typically, I mean, you don't really start on that until you've been practicing for at least 5 years. But if you haven't gone through something like that after 10 or 15 years of practice, then you're probably stuck somewhere. So, yeah, this is a very important point. Thank you.
But it can almost be like a skillful meaning to try it on.
Well, yes, like a skillful means on the part of the teacher. Well, you're quite right. However, this really goes to the philosophy of teaching, and I think one of the challenges we face in our culture, as Buddhism grows and fosters, develops. We used to have a system in university and in other areas of learning where the one person was recognized as the master, and that was it. And, I mean, you still have it to a certain extent in the medical profession, you know, and various other areas, and you just did whatever that person said, and they were responsible for leading you through various stages of understanding, which sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. But we've moved away from that in all of those areas and relying on the collective knowledge rather than one person being God. And we actually, in American culture, we distrust that. Now, spiritual circles and spiritual practice, all those are the most conservative elements of a society. So things change slowest there. We'll take a look at the Catholic Church. Very slow. And the concept of spiritual master is something we all want, the spiritual master. Who doesn't, you know? But I'm not really sure how viable it is in our culture. I'm really not. So this means there's going to be much more onus on the student to discover and explore and experiment until they find what works for them. And there are many Buddhist institutions which are wrestling with this. IMS is having some interesting times with precisely this problem, because when IMS started, it was the only game in town. It was the only game on the East Coast. In that particular arena. Now there's all kinds of other people doing other things like that. And they've seen a steady decline in enrollment for their programs because there's so many other alternatives and possibilities. And people are making their own decisions. And how to work with students and train students who have this panoply of options open to them, this is a new problem. It hasn't existed historically for... I think the last time it existed, really, was probably about the time of Buddha. Okay. Yes, Richard. Robert, sorry. I was an R, I was close. And if it isn't, I just sit here and look stupid, right? Okay, so resting in the experience of breathing, you found yourself knocking around between resting in the experiencer and resting in the experience of breathing?
Resting in breathing.
Resting in breathing. Well, what's the problem?
Well, I find it confusing. That's all. I'm not quite sure where to be.
Where are you right now? Well, if you approach it as a win-lose situation, I guess. The point here in our meditation practice, there's a tendency, for some of us anyway, to have a running commentary on our meditation. I think that is the source of the confusion. What if you drop the running commentary and just rest in the experience of breathing? What happens then? So what? I mean, yeah, but that's the edge of your practice, you know. Oh, I'm doing this thing. I mean, if you just rest in the breathing, that's fine. I mean, that's just words. But it's the commentary that's the problem. Yeah, it's hard to do. Of course it's hard. If it's easy, we wouldn't be here. Pardon?
That's why they call it practice.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think just say, oh, I'm going to stop the commentary. Gee, I almost stopped at that time. Let me. Now I'm giving. Oh dear, it just goes on and on, you know. And there's only one way to do it. Maybe there's more than one way. One way I found: go into the body. Go right into the body. See, the body's a very wonderful way of cutting through the cleverness of the intellect.
So how exactly did you do
that? Well, I'm going to tell you a story. Three-year retreat. Not the one I was in, but another one. A friend of mine is a tall, naturopathic chiropractor, very, very bright guy, almost psychic, who could out-argue anybody on anything. And another person in this retreat was a short, stocky guy, not particularly long on the gray matter, but very solid in the way he worked. And over the course of this retreat, this tall friend of mine would just beat this person up verbally over and over again on this and that and this and that. And finally, the short, stocky guy looked at him and said, "You say one more word, I'm going to thump you." And my friend explained to us, "Can you believe that? He threatened me with physical violence." But it's a very apt analogy, or, you know, that you're, when things get right down and dirty and physical, the intellect doesn't have anything to say. Right? it gets out of there completely. It can't deal with it. Well, this is very useful for our meditation practice. So, as I said last night, what breathes? Well, it's your body that breathes. So to experience breathing, to be in the experience of breathing, you're going to have to experience the body. So do that. Just experience the body breathing. And when you really do that, you'll find that every part of your body is involved with breathing. And if you have that in attention, you're not going to be giving any commentary. But it means relating to the body. Now, some of us have a little problem with that, but that's a whole other story. Does that help? Okay. Other questions? Yes?
I find a little contradiction in focusing on the body or coming back to the sense of body with keeping in mind a sense of no self.
Well, whoever said keep that in mind? I'm sorry to hear that.
Okay.
What good is an idea of no self to you?
I think I found it helpful. I think at times, there's times when, let's say, for instance, your tall, lanky friend who argued, you know, with a great intellect.
Yes. He had lots of ideas of no self.
I'm sure. He must have developed them a long time because he was good at it. But that sense of being able to verbally outdo somebody is building up a sense of self or a sense of identity and a sense of perhaps arrogance and...
apt descriptions.
Thank you. It seems sometimes...
But let's take a look at moving into non-self rather than an idea of non-self.
Okay?
So, right now. Be in your body. What are you experiencing physically? Whatever that is. Maybe feeling a little warm in the body. Maybe a little sleepy, you just had lunch. Maybe you're feeling relaxed. But whatever you're experiencing, maybe there are little tensions here and there. Maybe there's some discomfort, definite discomfort. Whatever it is, we just experience it. Now, what are you experiencing emotionally? Maybe a feeling of peace and quiet. Maybe a feeling of anxiety. Possibly irritation. Maybe curiosity. All of these things. And as you continue to experience the body, also experience all of those. And then there are all of the stories, the memories, associations that are going through our mind all the time. Don't try to block them. Just let them be there. Just experience them. But experience all three simultaneously. The body with all of its sensations, emotions and all of their sensations, and then the sensations of thoughts, memories, and associations. Just be in the experience of all of that. So what happens when you do that? What if you drop the dichotomy? And if you want, we can go at this another way, which may help you to drop the dichotomy. Would you like to do that? No.
I would.
But I'm curious, why don't you want to drop the dichotomy?
I don't know if I need to. I don't think there's such a big dichotomy. I mean, I can feel, I can test my body, I can test my emotions. I don't think it's a big...
But you like the watcher, do you?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I could see some sense of non-solidity to it all. Yeah, maybe that's what the watcher is.
Different traditions talk about the watcher. Mahamudra and Dzogchen traditions, we don't. The watcher is actually regarded as a bit of an impediment. That's why I was curious if you wanted to drop the dichotomy. It's not hard.
Okay.
Doesn't hurt.
Okay.
Famous last words. Okay, so... pick any object and rest your attention on it. That's called focus. And it can be anything. It can be your breath. It can be the shirt of the person in front of you. It can be the sound of the fan. It doesn't matter. Pick any object. Just rest with that. Now, using that as a base of attention, expand your awareness to include everything that is in your sensory awareness. Everything in the visual field. Everything in the field of sound, hearing, smell, taste, and touch, which includes all of the physical sensations in the body, all of the kinesthetic stuff. That's frame. So we have focus first, then frame. Resting in that awareness of everything that arises in sensory experience, include all the internal material, thoughts, feelings, emotions, memories, associations. Just include it. And then drop any sense of inside or outside. So you're just present. Okay. That's the practice. And that's something you can do anytime, anywhere. Good. Other questions? Roger. The topic of the day.
I'm not sure if you want to talk about something. I guess it's the word national karma. Sort of like you're born in this particular country where there's a particular national policy, time of computers, whatever it might be. And that works with that.
That's just a whole different way of using the words, or is that something that you can cut through with compassion? Good. So the question's about national karma, though I imagine the word he may have used might have been collective karma, that which is another term that's also used. Karma is as pervasive a worldview in Eastern societies as gravity is in ours. It's actually a lot of similarity between the two. We have the law of karma and the law of gravity, and nobody's figured out a way to break either of them. But try as we may, yes. Collective, or to use Trungpa's phrase, national karma, is a way of applying that view to entities other than the individual. And if we take American culture for instance, we can see working out on the national level the same kinds of processes that I was talking about this morning, so that the irrational fear that permeated the culture in the early stages of the Cold War reinforced itself, and that manifested as the arms race until it reached such absurd limits that the US and Russia had collectively enough nuclear power to wipe out every person in the world something like 100 times over. You know, it was more than could possibly be used. But that's exactly the result of a reactive process. So you can see that playing out. Now, that defines the milieu in which we live and function. What can we change that? Very difficult. For instance, before the Iraq War, there was something like worldwide upwards of 10 million people protesting against a war before it had even started. Now, politically, that's unheard of. Nothing like that has ever happened, which says a lot about where world political processes have evolved to. I mean, that's an amazing thing. Certainly there wasn't anything like that kind of opposition before the Vietnam War. It didn't change anything, though, because the dynamics which were moving towards the Iraq War had been set in motion in 1978, and this was the culmination of them. And you can't change things that when they have that much momentum. But not, it's very, very difficult to. So to say that one can just cut through it in the sense of actually change it, that's probably unrealistic. I mean, you know how difficult it is to cut through the momentum of your own reactive patterns. Yes. However, we can, and cut through our own confusion and see things clearly. And that's what I was suggesting, that compassion has a key role in being able to do that. And I think that's very much at the essence of practice, that we aren't confused by whatever the cultural or social milieu in which we are born into manifests. But that's actually quite hard. Yeah. You want to follow up?
You said something when you were talking about that it's not a matter of insight, it's a matter of compassion.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting distinction. I mean, it seems like it's insightful.
Okay. Well, the way I arrived at that is that in considering the Zen priests who were caught up in the Japanese war effort, you couldn't short them on insight. That's what Zen specializes in, above all else, you know, seeing into the nature of things. So that obviously wasn't the answer. And so I said, okay, well, let's consider compassion. And, for instance, we know of many cultural traditions which are accepted as perfectly legitimate practice, and it's the way people act, which cause tremendous suffering. And yet, in various cultures, there are always individuals, not very many, who may not make any big fanfare, but don't buy that particular social custom, and sometimes actively work against it, but certainly help people who are victimized by it. And, okay, how do those people develop in the culture? What was the special characteristic of those people? Because they were born in the same culture, and yet they aren't fooled by the culture. And it seemed to me that it was a matter of compassion, because they could see the suffering that was there. And there was, and what they're doing is a response to the suffering. And it's not really about understanding, it's a direct response to the suffering. Yes, but it's not always the case that they've suffered themselves. No. I mean, well, I don't want to go there. I want to get back to our topic of the day, which is karma, but I need to lay a little bit of groundwork, which is going to go to your question about sentient beings and doing good and all. So we'll start it off with a small question. What is life? Or, of what does life consist? Yes. Well, say the time period between birth and death. Okay. Life is the boundary or the between birth and death. Okay. And that sounds good. Now, of what does that consist? Can you go any further with that, Kamal? That wasn't much of a step forward. Okay. What are experiences? What do experiences consist of? Pardon? Physical sensations. Anything else? Now, we perceive change. So, physical sensations, thoughts, anything else? Emotions, yes. Not feelings. Yeah, feelings and emotions. Okay. That's what life is.
But that's human life.
Well, you know any? Do you know of any other?
Well, I mean, when you say life, it could be anything that grows and
oh, but that. But you see, that's an abstraction. We're going to get there in a minute. Our experience, what we call life, being alive, is a process of experience. Right? We experience thoughts, we experience feelings, and we experience sensations, sensory sensations. That's it. Those are along the thoughts, feelings, okay? That's it. Thoughts, feelings, sensations. That's all you've got to work with. That's all any of us have got to work with. That's it. Now, so nice and bright. All of you see, at least I'm assuming all of you see, I should make sure, a red cup, right? Anybody here who doesn't? Okay. Let's just focus on the red quality. Make it easy. You see red. I don't mean you're angry, I just see red. Okay? Where is the seeing? In your mind, in your con. Where's that? No, I asked it. Where is the seeing? Between? Somewhere out here? Yeah, well, you're talking about the old binding problem now. But where is the seeing? It's not so straightforward, is it?
No.
Is it? The see- well, we'll posit a place based on beliefs, but when you really look at it, you know, you just let go of those beliefs, as we're trying to do today, it's not straightforward where it is it? You can't say it's in here, and you can't say it's out there, because it's in here. So there it is. Seeing red is arising in experience, but we can't say where it is. Everything is like that. Everything. Pardon? Okay. Let's not get it complicated yet. That's I mean, all of these things come up. But seeing is arising. I mean, we all have that experience. It's a nice, vivid experience. I mean, nobody said they didn't see red. And but when we look at where is that seeing, it's like, that's not exactly straightforward. Now, there's also, I don't think, any dispute about there's a red cup, right? What I want to suggest is that the concept red cup and the view that there is an object called a red cup is an abstraction from the world of our actual experience, and we create or build up this idea, well, there's a red cup. And it's kind of a shorthand. So we don't have to check, do you see that somewhat cylindrical sensation of red with a white rim at the top? And we can just say, no, do you see the red cup? And you say, yeah, I see the red cup. So we abstract from our world of experience the idea that objects exist. Are you with me? Yes. Pardon? Yeah, we do this in order to communicate, in order to organize our experience. But now something very important happens. We forget that this world of shared experience, red cup and so forth, is an abstraction. And we take it to be real.
Why is it an
abstraction? What's the cup? Okay. You're describing it, but what is it?
An object in space.
Okay. Now, how do you know that object's there? Ah, but when I asked you, do you see the red, you didn't know where the red was, so how can you say the object's there?
Because I've been told, my belief system is telling me that everything I see is out there.
That's exactly right. That's the belief system.
So, and yet, you're telling me that maybe it's not out there. It's very, very confusing.
You're right on the money. Glad to hear it. Yes.
So is it out there or is it not out there?
What
are
I'm
you out there or are you just a
no,
I'm just, of mine? The whole room.
That's right. I know, that's just the shits, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah.
But that's right. All I am is a voice in your world of experience, which you happen to be listening to, and now you're probably regretting it.
The question is, I'm going to come away more confused, or less confused, or completely baffled, or with more of a mushy brain than I already have.
Well, we'll see in a few days. Yeah. Didier.
You can't just see my creation, or you can't just see her creation, right now,
yes, that just means I'm part of your world too. That how do you know that the me that she's listening to is the me that you're listening to?
Or that you didn't create me listening to him.
Exactly. What we have here is the raw experience is a world we cannot share with anybody else. In California, we have this wonderful expression, share the experience.
Okay.
Sure, it's dated, but it's useful for my purposes. How many Californians does it take to change a light bulb? No, just one to change a light bulb, five to share the experience. But it illustrates the point, You can't share an experience. I can talk to you about my experience, and you may get some flavor from that. But there is no way that you can experience what I'm experiencing, and there's no way that I can experience what you're experiencing. It's not possible.
Is this the essential
aloneness? Yeah. No. One moment. No. Out of that experience, we construct a world that we use for communication. And that I refer to as the world of shared experience, which consists of objects. And we can share those objects, like, would you like this cup? And I can actually give you this cup. I can't give you my experience, but I can give you this cup. Now, is your experience of the cup the same as my experience of the cup? No. No way of knowing that. No basis of comparison, even. But we can share objects in the world, and, money and clothes and food and things like that. There's food up until the point that we're tasting it, then it becomes an experience. It's a little more difficult. And this is very important because we have the idea, based on our belief that there is this external world, that we are born into this world and at some time we leave it. But from the point of view of all we have is our world of experience, that's a completely wrong way of looking at things. What happens is, something happens and we begin to experience things. And we just go on experiencing things, and then that world of experience ends. So it begins when we are born, it continues while we are alive, and it ends when we die. And there isn't any sense of being born into a world or out of the world. There's just the world of our experience.
Is it possible that it doesn't end for us, but the experience of us ends for the people that are here?
Well, that's exactly what happens.
Do we even know whether it ends for us?
No, we can't. You know, and it's...
It's projecting that it ends for us because it ends for everybody else.
Exactly. That's right. So, and what Buddhism is talking about when it's talking about the world is not the universe as we understand it in science. It's talking about the world of total experience, which is, and this is the vocabulary I use, the world of total experience is what we ourselves experience, and then the world of shared experience is what we abstract from that world to create a world of that seems to be external. Now, when you're talking this morning about karma, whatever we do, that's in our world of total experience. And whatever you put into that world, it can't go anywhere else. So when we lie, kill, steal, all of these things, or when we do good and help people and be generous and speak kindly to them, all of that's in our world of experience. So our actions become very important because that's what shapes our world of experience. Yes?
Well, I have a couple of questions based on this. Are you, in some sense, suggesting a return to kind of the primordial nature of us before we became creatures of abstraction and had knowledge and were able to actually nurse illusion? The presumption is before they picked the tree, they weren't operating on illusions, they were naked, they were simply living a good life. Are you, in a sense, returning to that? And the second thing is it possible to turn the clock back anyway, or once the cat's out of the bag, in this case, knowledge, abstraction is available, there's language, illusion. Therefore, how can we live with both our primordial nature, if that's what you're trying to get back to, and yet also be civilizing, abstracting creatures? That it seems to me that there's a rub there.
Yes. So, using the Garden of Eden as a analogy or illustration, are we trying to move back to a primordial knowing, and is it possible to live in, does one have to choose one or the other, or is it possible to live in both the primordial knowing and then as a symbolic creature also? But, yeah. Okay. Well, do we have a choice? We have a choice one way, and that is to continue to ignore the primordial knowing. Do you have a choice about ignoring the experience of being individual, symbolic individuals? There's no choice there. So we either ignore or we open to the totality of things, which includes that. And essentially what you're talking about in Buddhist terminology, and there are various ways one could gloss this in Buddhist terminology, but one way is what is ultimately true and what is apparently true, which many of you will know as absolute and relative, but I don't like those translations. What is ultimately true is experience. What is relatively or apparently true is that we exist individually, etc., etc. And Mahayana Buddhism aims at coming to know that that is how things are, that they aren't in opposition, they are both, they arise, and that is what we experience. And so, yes, that's exactly what we have to do, is to learn how to live in both. You follow? Right. You had a question back here. You sure? Right, yes.
Let's see. This stuff comes and goes. It's very slippery for me. But in your book, you said first we wake up to what is apparently true, and then we wake up to what is true.
That's one way of going, yes.
I think that's what you were referring to.
And
just now?
Yes. It's not the only path, but it's the path that is most fruitful for most people.
And it seems to me that that it's painful to me that what is apparently true. Very,
yes.
Very painful. And so that's a motivation to wake up to what is ultimately true.
You think it makes it less painful?
Do we have a choice? No.
It's not about pain.
No.
It's about being awake.
But my question is, it's about the contemplation this morning and going through the four results.
Yes.
And I think that what I read in the book was something about patterns operate to decay attention so that the emotional core of the pattern does not experience.
Yes.
And so, if that is what triggers the pattern, the avoidance of the emotional core, is that what I'm...
Go on.
Okay. I didn't have too much of a problem experiencing in my contemplation lots of examples of this kind of pattern in my life in various places. What I couldn't discern immediately was, what is the emotional core? What am I avoiding here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see what the result is, and I have a hard time saying, okay, is that what I was avoiding in the first place? Now, so that's not very clear to me.
So, the patterns are triggered in order to avoid experiencing the emotional core. How do you discern what the emotional core is? Can we defer that one till tomorrow or the next day?
Do I have a choice?
Yes. You can say, no, that's not all right. Okay, thank you. But do bring it up again. I'm pretty sure I will get to it, but if I shouldn't, then by all means bring it up again. Yeah, Susan.
You spoke about action creating unreality. Is that a little bit as if you were in a room and you were in the office and
That's kind of an interesting analogy. Not sure how far I'd push it, but it is much more of a closed system than we realize. Well, what we put out goes into our experience. It can't go anywhere else. It's in our experience. That's it. Yeah. But all of that's our experience. What we experience as other people are just experiences. That's why there are no sentient beings. What we experience as other people are just experiences. That's why there are no sentient beings.
So we're an experience, experiencing.
Well, if you wish to put it that way, yes.
Not an open being.
Pardon?
If there are no sentient beings, then that's
Absolutely. If there are no sentient beings, that includes us. But that's what we said last night. You know, we're under the illusion that we exist.
Right. When you talked about the all-knowing.
Pardon?
You talked about the experience that, you know, if the cup is my, this is all my dream.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the mind? Me having the dream.
There's
still a dualistic language. Isn't the problem the language?
No. We approach language like Humpty Dumpty. You know, how many of you, Humpty Dumpty, Alice in Wonderland? We use language. Okay. So, Roger asks, well, who's the my? Well, that's the question, isn't it?
So when you relax into your breath entirely.
Okay, you relax into your breath entirely.
To me, that means total relaxation means relaxing the tension between watcher and watching. That it's dissolving. So there's simply that.
Yes. Right. And this is the difference between Buddhism and solipsism. Solipsism says, I am the universe. I am the world. And Buddhism comes along and says, who are you? What are you? And there's no one there. That's exactly right.
We are the experience and the
experiencer.
And experiencing other experiences.
But
everything is
within
experience.
Yeah. Right. Now, our challenge is to know that directly, not as an idea, but to know it experientially. So, and that's what all Buddhist practice is about. And to do that, you have to develop a level of attention which can experience not existing. That's what I said last night. Now it maybe makes a little more sense. Last question that I want to return to the practice.
When you talk about how you need a certain amount of power to show up, so to speak, at the same time as your endeavor to be present, how your effort, the tension that we've been talking about can sometimes be the only, in other words, it goes, you start innocently enough with the process that seems to be unfolding nicely, and you end up with something that is nothing but trying.
Well, you're echoing T.S. Eliot's words in Four Quartets. For us, there is only the trying, the rest is not our business. And. Say it again.
We know when we come here that we all have an intention to try to do something here, and we have this take a certain amount of power to stay with that. But sometimes the innocence of our practice. That combined with a certain naivete at the end of the practice that way, somehow, unbeknownst to, we're not really sure why we end up with nothing but trying. That's describing the tension between watcher and watching, there's nothing but that tension.
See, as we practice, we all come into practice with certain ideas. I'm going to get enlightened and bring an end to suffering. How many of you started with that idea? I know I did. Yeah. Okay. And, I mean, sometimes it's other things. I'm going to join with the universal self. That's Brahma or Atman. Okay. And I'm going to come to be one with that which is beyond death. So I'm going to live forever, right? And I'm going to become totally pure. These are all different ways, different motivations people come into practice. But as you practice, one begins to appreciate that those actual ideas are part of the problem. And you begin to see that any kind of holding to a fixed idea is part of the problem. So, I mean, speaking a little ironically perhaps, but you end up making more and more effort to achieve less and less. And when I say more and more effort, I do not mean nose to the grindstone effort. That's in that little exercise that we did, which is focus, field, internal material, and presence. How much effort did that take? Pardon? How many say it took a lot? How many say it took a little? Yeah. Okay. We'll do it another way, okay? Unbeknownst to you, over the lunch hour, I planted a number of bombs in this building. They're set to go off in 20 seconds. This is it. You're not going to experience anything other than this. How much effort did it take you to come here? Just right in that moment. Not much, right? You just need a little push. Okay. It takes no effort, or very little effort, to move into presence. Or it takes very little force, should we say, to move into presence. And as you work in your practice, that's what you end up with your effort. It's just that little move. So you're just there. And in that moment, I mean, when I said that and you're thinking, oh God, that's it? What were you holding on to? Nothing to hold on to because there was nothing to do. That was it. Now, can you live that way? And then we get into the whole conundrum of life. How do you live that way and deal with the fact that we don't know when we're going to die, but we do know we're going to die, and all of those things? And that's the conundrum that you're posing. Living in what is and dealing with everything that arises in our lives. Yes?
That's really an interesting thing. This notion of trying all the time. I know I'm familiar with that notion of trying. You said this morning about I got here about 8:15 and I came into this room and I sat down right in the spot. And I had never done exactly what you said this morning because it had never occurred to me to breathe, to see myself as a breather, as a breather, however, because it's usually my lungs taking in air and then letting out. In,
yeah.
And this morning I felt like I just breathing, breathing, body. Well, in almost enough time, I had an unusual experience that I had before, which was when I took it off my lungs. I saw my body. It's just a silhouette almost. And then suddenly, the T-bill that my lungs are went off. And there was a sense of the whole thing going, it's like on TV. And then it's something really scary. Yeah. And then I realized it was scary, but I was having the non-existence of certain things,
yes.
Breathing way, certain things, breathing that way, having a dial earth or having a dog earth or a game that's around me. That was the space around me. And that was it. And then you walked in. Right.
Yeah, damned if you do, damned if you don't, what do you do? Okay. So, by just relating...
No effort.
That's exactly. Okay.
It just happens.
Yeah, and the distinction I'm making, I'm just changing the word slightly, is it doesn't take any force. But it does take an effort. You have to place the attention a certain way. And that's what you did. And then you're just there. Now, there are many, many different ways of placing the attention, but none of them require any force. And that's one of the things, as practice matures, that's what you begin to appreciate, that all of that forcing, and I'm a great candidate for trying to push and push and push and push and push. And some of us are very slow about these things. But it's just there. Why don't we take a short break and stretch, and then I want to come back, get some of your experience, and we'll do some more meditation.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.